Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast,
showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Green Minds podcast. Today, I'm delighted to announce that our guest is Will Martindale, Director of Policy and Research at the URI. So firstly, thank you very much, Will, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe if we could start by you telling the listeners a bit about the work that PRI do, and in particular, your role within the organisation.
Yeah, very much. So PRI, we call it, is the UN-backed Principles for Responsible Investment. And it's an investor initiative that was launched in 2006 by the then UN General Secretary Kofi Annan. And it's a collaboration of institutional investors, so pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, insurance funds, their asset managers and their service providers that work together to commit and implement a set of six principles that in aggregate help us move towards a more sustainable financial system. And we've got about 3,000 members as of today and collectively managing around 90 trillion of assets. So we've got scale. And my job is responsible for policy and research. So we work with academics on a series of academic research projects in order to really try and answer some of the technical questions that our members might be struggling with in seeking their sustainable investment objectives. And then from a policy perspective, we're working in five core markets to help advance regulation and policy to both enable and in some jurisdictions require the consideration and integration of ESG issues, sustainability issues, environmental, social, and governance issues in the way in which investors understand their investment processes.
You mentioned these technical questions. Could you maybe give us an idea of what those could include?
ESG and sustainable finance is a fairly broad concept. So there can be questions around process. So does systematically integrating sustainability issues support financial outperformance? And we have undertaken a lot of academic research. But then there may be questions around things like, what are the ways in which policymakers can support a just transition? And we've seen some excellent academic research that's tested a number of different ways in which policymakers and indeed investors and stakeholders are thinking about this and shared their results. So you're seeing sort of two very diverse examples there and really everything in between.
I can imagine in the current context with COVID going on and all the discussions now in terms of how countries and investors should respond to the current situation and rebuild, is that something which is being discussed a lot in your work? Is there, what are the sort of themes that are coming up around that subject?
Yeah, again, so it's a good question. And in some respects, a very broad set of responses that we're getting. And so at the moment, we're struggling to provide a clear framework. But if I was forced to do so as of now, I'd say that investors are thinking through in terms of monetary policy. So the ways in which central banks can align the actions that they take in order to support a fair, inclusive, and green society. That may include things like green sovereign bonds and the way in which bond proceeds can be attributed towards a country's sustainability or climate commitments. And then the attention of investors, again, turning to fiscal policy, in things like, should the aviation industry be receiving bailout financing? And if they do, what requirements should be for the aviation industry in terms of how they manage their commitments to be low carbon over the next 20, 30 years? Or what about the energy industry and the very low oil prices that we've got now? What does that mean in terms of the way in which fossil fuel subsidies have worked in the past? And should fiscal policy be supporting industry to align to an energy framework that will allow us to meet our climate consideration? And the third sort of policy considerations that are being considered in the post-COVID response is around capital markets policy. So what are the disclosure requirements that we should be looking for from companies that receive public money? And how can we create multiplier effects by investors crowding in terms of their investment activity that can then help support economic recovery, but can do it in a way that's sustainable? So, you know, huge questions that we're grappling with. We definitely don't have answers to these at the moment, but demonstrates the breadth of the thinking underway within the sustainable finance community.
Yeah, I think it's really an incredible opportunity to reconsider a lot of things, the way things have worked until now, and rebuild in a more resilient way as well. One of the particularly spoken about policy tools recently is the EU taxonomy. I was wondering if you see this as a particularly useful tool in the context of rebuilding, in the context of, as you say, driving investments and crowding in. Is that something that you see being used?
Yeah, I absolutely do. If it's okay, let me just take a minute to explain the EU taxonomy, because it's not that widely understood. And so in order to do so, I think worth backtracking a couple of years to a plan that was published by the Financial Directorate within the European Commission around sustainable finance, and it committed to several areas of policy reform, one of which was the publication of a taxonomy underpinned by regulation. So a taxonomy is essentially just a list. It's a list of economic activities, such as things like steel production or passenger car kilometer, and then a measurement, so whether or not that economic activity is sustainable, so 50 grams of CO2 per passenger car kilometer. And those technical criteria have been published by an advisory group that they published a couple of months ago, back in March of 2020. And the Commission is now working through that, and in a sense, we'll codify that in regulation by the end of this year. Now, the requirement for investors is to disclose against that taxonomy, so to take the assets in which they invest, determine where those assets derive their revenue streams from, and then whether or not those revenue streams meet those thresholds that are set out in the taxonomy. If they do, they can consider those activities sustainable. Now, the reason why this is important for the recovery is because it's probably the best framework that currently exists to understand whether or not an economic activity is consistent with the EU's commitment to be carbon neutral by 2050, and interim targets is set for 2030 and 2025. And so while still working its way through the legislative process, yes, absolutely, it would be my view that this is a tool that should be used by institutional investors, but potentially also governments, to understand what type of activities are consistent with that state of the world that we need in the future, and therefore which ones should be subject to preferential treatment as part of the recovery.
Right, I guess so. Would that tie in then to the disclosure point regarding capital markets, that way you see the taxonomy coming in as well?
Yeah, exactly. So companies should be required to disclose against the taxonomy. They're going to be required to do so anyway, but maybe there should be some way in which that disclosure element is attached to the way in which countries are thinking about public stimulus, and the way in which they would use taxpayers' money in order to support the recovery. And obviously the disclosure needs to come first in order to understand where to be spending that money.
There was actually something I was quite interested in reading the other day around emerging markets and some of the challenges involved in promoting like a green recovery there as well. I was wondering, is there anything you've kind of read about or you've been involved in which would be particularly interesting to for our listeners to hear about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that unfortunately emerging markets is too broad a term. The specificities of different markets need to be understood to understand the challenge they've got with their recovery. So the South African economy, for example, is more than 90% of energy provision is more than 90% powered by coal. So there's specific challenges around that, and couple that with a very high unemployment rate, particularly black unemployment, and the deep social injustice that has marred South Africa's history, and you've got a real challenge in terms of working through how public stimulus and recovery can be used there to meet both the sort of health implications of the current crisis, the long-term economic ones, but also the long-term sustainability ones. That's obviously very different to a country like Mexico or China, which you may also categorize as an emerging market, but it's sort of different sets of issues that those countries are wrestling with. So yes, big challenges, big capital raising challenges for the government, possibly big energy challenges as well, and probably need to have a sort of deeper dive at country level in order to really get to grips with that.
Right, yeah, that makes sense. Taking a step back, I was wondering just in terms of ESG investing in general, obviously, there's been a lot of talk about it before all of this happened, and there have been reports that actually investing in ESG is continued during the current pandemic. I was wondering, are there any of the three elements in ESG, so the environmental, the social, the governance factors, which you think will become particularly important as we come out of this current situation? I know you mentioned the social aspects in South Africa. Is that something, maybe the social aspect, which you think will gain in traction?
Yeah, so I can just take apart your question a little. So conservative ESG investing is one that might be challenged by some of your listeners. So ESG can be both a strategy and a risk management technique. So risk management technique would interpret ESG as it would any other financially material risk. It would say, do these issues affect the financial performance of the asset in which I'm investing? And if they do, then I need to understand how and then incorporate that in how I make my investment decision. ESG as a strategy may say, well, I'm looking to pursue a particular environmental or social goal. So for example, I want to make sure that the companies in which I invest have diverse boards. Maybe they have a minimum proportion of women on the board, or that they have good supply chain policies with respect to maternity rights and equal pay. And so they may be strategy, and the two things may be linked. So the fact that the company has a good diversity policy may mean that it can demonstrate financial outperformance, and it manages the financial risks that may be associated with not having a good maternity policy. And so they may be linked, but the intention might be different there, and I think it's important to understand that distinction. Now, in terms of the second part of your question, you know, what do we think that this crisis will mean for the various different components of ESG? Well, I think that the concept of responsible investment has held strong during this crisis. I think that many of the issues that ESG talks to have been perpetuated by this crisis, and so by considering those issues and making sure that they're fully incorporated in the way in which an investor understands financial risk and return means that the investment thesis has held up during this crisis, and arguably there's a number of studies I've seen that demonstrate that deep financial outperformance. Now the thing that I think may follow this crisis is more attention to social issues. So things like labor rights and indeed human rights, where we're seeing even in the US, which at the moment is not known for having a progressive regulatory regime on these topics, are attaching stipulations around labor rights to the way in which bailout money is being used. And so investors are turning their attention to that, rightly so, and arguably some evidence suggests that they will continue to do so once the crisis is more under control.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think you're very right to make the distinction between the risk management aspect and in terms of setting the goals. I think that's an important distinction to make. As another of the principles of PRI, which I was particularly interested in, is the second one, so around active ownership and engaging. I was wondering, what role do you see for that in general, and then also just in the current context that we're in?
So active ownership or stewardship, as it's sometimes referred to, is obviously an incredibly important part of the way investors interpret their responsibilities. Often, some argue that the roots of stewardship are in the K review that came out of the last major crisis we had from an economic perspective after the financial crisis, when Lord Kay was commissioned by the UK government to publish analysis on the response to the crisis. One of the things that then followed was the UK Stewardship Code, and different forms of stewardship code have been published in many other markets, including notably in Japan, when there was a shift in Japan away from fixed income investment towards equity investment in order to enable the provision of a retirement income for an aging Japanese population, and then supported that shift with an improved corporate governance and stewardship framework. The concept of stewardship is becoming more and more understood within the investment community. Stewardship is arguably where responsible investment can sort of prove its worth. It's probably a clumsy form of words, but hopefully you understand, where you have the supply of capital, so the institutional investors meet the users of capital, so the companies, and that relationship comes together in the stewardship conversations when investors are engaging companies on the way in which they're managing their business. And increasingly, we're seeing investors put pressure on companies to make changes consistent with sustainability objectives. And if your listeners are particularly interested in looking at a real world example of this right now, is around the upcoming Exxon AGM, and that a number of investors have publicly committed to vote against various aspects set out in that AGM because they feel that Exxon is not taking its climate objectives seriously enough. And that's an example of where stewardship really can change corporate behavior, which then has real world impact. And arguably, we need much, much more of this. Some would argue that the problem at the moment we've got is that stewardship kind of falls between the cracks. It's not properly rewarded in the way in which financial fees are paid. As savers, as individuals, we're rarely asking our pension provider to tell us how they're voting on topics that we may care about. And so as a sort of resource, if you like, within the way in which responsible investment works, is very underused at the moment. A huge amount of progress for that in the years to come.
That's really interesting. There's another aspect of PRI's work which I've been reading about recently, around setting targets and impact targets in ESG investing goals, and setting a legal framework for this impact measurement of investment activity. I was wondering, is that something you could tell us a bit more about?
Yeah, this is a flagship project for PRI. It's a collaboration of PRI, UN Environment, and then the Generation Foundation, which is the foundation arm of Generation Investment Management, which is an investment management firm set up by Vice President Al Gore and then David Blood, who previously worked at Goldman Sachs. And we've commissioned the UK law firm Freshfields to understand the extent to which investors can prioritize a sustainability outcome in how they interpret their investment activity. So an example might be that I'm managing a fund and I want to set a target that my fund is consistent with well below 2 degrees of warming. Now, there may well be a financial motivation for me to do that. One may say that companies that are consistent with the future state of the world are the companies that are going to perform well over the next few years. But actually, my primary objective is that I don't want my fund to be inconsistent with the Paris Climate Agreement. Or another example, maybe quality of life in retirement. I want my fund to be able to provide for me a quality of life in retirement. And that means that I want to live in a community and a country which has certain characteristics. One might be, for example, good quality education or good quality publicly available healthcare. My motivation for that, again, is an outcome. It's a societal outcome. So the provision of good quality education or good quality publicly available healthcare. And what we're working through with Freshfields right now is, does the law provide for that? Can I do that within the way in which law is currently defined? And I can't share the answers with you just now, but would be very happy to come back and do that again in about 6 months when the analysis is complete. We aim to have this research public by about October of this year.
That's great. Okay, that's something to look forward to. And then just to finish, the question I always ask my guests, which is a slightly more abstract one, which is, imagine we're in 2049, so 1 year away from having to be net zero. And it's the question would be, how do you foresee the world looking, and what would be your ideal situation which find ourselves by 2049?
Yeah, okay. So I think that we see three scenarios. And I'm then going to conclude by saying which one scenario I think will happen. So the first scenario is that we have deep international collaboration in the very near term now, which leads to a smooth transition, which leads to rapid decarbonisation in a fair and just way. And therefore, 2049 will be if not already there, would be well on the path there to be carbon neutral, and climate change as a concern just won't exist. That's scenario one. Scenario two is that we carry on to an extent as we are, and during the course of 2020s and maybe into the early 2030s, we have rapid and disruptive policy change. So things like the school strike movement, but potentially other community groups as well, are become increasingly vocal, and policymakers realize they then have to act. And when they act, they have to act in a disruptive and volatile way, because at that point, so much carbon would have been emitted that we're having to go far more quickly than we would have done if we'd have taken action sooner. And then the third scenario is the sort of very bleak scenario that no action takes place, and actually we have very severe weather events, as frankly, as we've seen in the past 6 months, but on the Australian fires and so forth, but on an increasingly frequent basis, and actually the world isn't a particularly pleasant place in which to live. Now, those are the three scenarios. I'd be interested. I mean, if your viewers can see if your listeners can see alternative scenarios, and then please let me know. But I think those are the three possible pathways. And I think that of the three, it's the second scenario here, this disruptive policy change, which probably unfortunately is the most probable. Obviously, we're still working towards the first scenario, but unfortunately, sort of decline in multilateralism, the approach taken by some countries, US in particular, on these types of topics, would suggest that the challenge in meeting that is still quite a long way away.
It's a good challenge to set the listeners. I'll make sure to let you know if anyone gets back with any alternative scenarios. Thank you very much for having joined us today, Will. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us and tell us a bit about your work at PRI.
Thanks for having me.